man. It's really nice to see you all. Thank you for inviting me to join you and to speak with you tonight. Tonight, I want to just share a few sort of musings about Zen practice and memory. You know, there's kind of an idea about Zen that it's all about, you know, being in the now, moment to moment awareness, mindfulness, just this, our actual present tense experience. And, you know, there's some truth to that, you know. And yet, it leaves kind of a question, I guess, of where does that leave us in terms of memory? And I've just been thinking about that. And so really, this is just, you know, I'm just sort of sharing some of my thinking with you. It's, you know, a little bit of a work in progress. But I'm also wondering about how practice can actually shift our relationship to memory. And I'm going to start by reading a part of a Dharma talk that I gave at this retreat that we just had, the Secret of the Streambed retreat. This is the beginning of a talk that I gave there. And so some of you have heard this and some of you have not. But it's kind of an invocation of some memory, some memories for me. I grew up on the Texas Gulf Coast, where it's hot and muggy most of the year. My mom was a single mom, and on weekends we'd go to the beach with her and her friends and their kids. We'd load a cooler full of sandwiches and Fresca into our 1969 Blue Ford station wagon that we had named the Blue Dragon. The drive was about an hour, and we'd get kind of sleepy, but we knew we were almost there when we went over the bridge, and the bridge went up and over a causeway that dropped up and then right down, and that movement always set off a kind of a whoop-de-doo in my stomach. And that feeling meant almost there. It was always really hot at Galveston. And that was really, I think, in the days before sunscreen. So we got very sunburned a lot. The sand on the beach was coarse. And I remember the feeling of digging my toes into the sand. There were tar balls everywhere on that beach and in the water. And there were oil derricks just offshore. And it smelled like sulfur. There were flocks of shorebirds feeding at the tide line, and we would run and scare them into flight to watch their graceful rise. They'd fly up and then just fly, you know, a little ways down the beach and settle back down as a flock. Brown pelicans would fly by, low and stately, patrolling the coast. They looked like pterodactyls to me. We would play in the waves for hours. I would do front flips and back flips with the energy of the waves. My body arced and curled, tumbling, rolling, salt water in my nose and ears. And sometimes when I got tired, I'd dive under the waves and find that still cool place that was always there underneath the waves, a place where I could rest. And we played for hours with a beach ball, rolling it, throwing it, spinning it through the air, its colors whirling, moving between us and bouncing on the water. So in these reflections, I'm recalling my sense memories of this time. I'm recalling how my body felt in interaction with the contours of the land and the water and the air. It's really a portrait of a self in landscape, and maybe even self as landscape, or landscape as self. There's a lovely koan that I think has a sense of this quality of memory. A student asked Feng Shui, "Speech and silence are concerned with equality and differentiation. How can I be free from them?" Feng Shui said, "I always remember Jiangyan in March. Partridges chirp among the many fragrant blossoms." I've always loved that koan because Feng Shui kind of, I guess, legitimizes memory as a function of the mind and as a response to an urgent question. But he's really giving a sense memory of Jiangnan in March and what it's like when the partridges are chirping and the blossoms are fragrant. There's another way I could have told the story about my visits to the beach at Galveston. Another version of that story could be something like, "I remember the summer that I was 7. My parents had just gotten divorced, and my mom took my sister and I to the beach a lot. I think that summer marked a time of both loss and freedom for all of us. The afternoons that we spent at Galveston brought us closer together, and we had fun too." Now, that's a very different kind of memory. That's what I would call a narrative memory. I'm telling a story in which really I'm the sort of the protagonist of the story. It's a story about me and what happened at a particular time in my life and what it was like for me. And it also kind of generalizes a lot. I'm sort of remembering a sort of an overall feeling of loss, of fun, And I'm telling a story about events that I'm kind of stringing together. And so that's another maybe kind of memory that we could identify. If the first is an example of sense memory, this would be an example of narrative memory. Now, narrative memories seem to show up in koans, often as a story of the student who comes to a teacher, and the student is telling their story. So here's an example of that in the koans. A student came to a teacher and said, "I am Qing Shi, solitary and destitute. Please give me alms." Zhao Shan said, "Venerable Shui." King Shui said, "Yes, sir." Zhao Shan said, "You have already drunk 3 cups of the finest wine in China, yet you say that you have not moistened your lips." So in this koan, the student, Qing Shi, really comes in with a story about himself as solitary and destitute. And I'm not even saying that that's bad or a problem. I'm sure that's how he felt. He was probably, you know, really feeling desperate and looking for something. And yet, you know, what he came with is something that we all do a lot, which is to tell a story about ourselves. It's sort of a narrative about how I feel and how I am moving through the world. And, you know, there's nothing, you know, intrinsically wrong at all with narrative memory. It's part of being human. And in fact, there can be something really helpful about putting together narrative memory. For example, there was a time in my life when it was really important for me to tell the story about the summer that I was 7 to myself and to a therapist, and to realize that that summer that my parents got divorced was actually more upsetting to me than I had realized. And that because of that, I had a hard time sleeping. And that had ripple effects that affected my life. And so telling a story that made more sense was really helpful to me. However, the problem with narrative memories is that they can get kind of rigid and stuck and thick, and they can obstruct us. We get caught in rigid stories about who I am or who you are, or, you know, who my parents are, the way the world is, or what's possible, or what's wrong with me, you know. All of the stories that we tell without even really knowing that we're doing it. And they get just heavy and kind of repetitive and limiting. They limit our freedom. They're kind of defining a narrow version of who we think we are. And I want to just throw in here that I actually think there's another kind of memory that is worth mentioning, because I think we all have it to one degree or another. And that's a kind of a traumatic memory. And when any of us has a trauma, and we all do, you know, have to some degree some trauma in our lives. Some people are marked by that, you know, significantly, and others are lucky enough to not have it really saturate their lives. But for anybody who's subject to trauma, it does something in particular to our minds and to our memories. And there's a koan that I think actually does represent this. It's the koan about which is the true Qian. So I'm going to read it. A young woman named Qian was in love with a young woodworker that she had known since she was a child. And she had always believed herself to be betrothed to him. But she was arranged to be married to a rich merchant by her father. And the night before the ceremony, the woodworker was heartbroken, couldn't face the ceremony, and he packed his things into a boat to leave the village. And as he was about to leave, Qian came running after the boat, and they eloped together. Years later, she and her lover, now married, returned home to make amends to her family for their sudden departure. Qian waited in the boat while her husband approached her father to take responsibility. Her father seemed bewildered. "What are you talking about? After the night you left, she refused to marry and has lain ill in her bed ever since." The father showed the husband to Qian's bedroom, where she lay unconscious, pale, and emaciated. Astonished, the husband went to tell his wife of this strange happening. Right before his eyes, the Qian he had married came running from the boat where she had been waiting, and the Qian he had left behind came running from her bedroom. Running toward each other, they collided and became one. Which is the true Qian? So this is a story about a person, Qian, who in the face of a great loss, you know, of her beloved, kind of splits into two. And this is something that can happen to anybody who's subject to trauma. We become kind of divided in our minds, and our memories can become divided. I think we can all relate in one way or another to the feeling of being a divided self. And sometimes it feels like I've got a young part and a mature part, or a sick part and a well part, or a good part and a bad part. And with trauma, there can be a part who can remember and a part that doesn't remember, or that remembers differently. In the story, the Qian who ran off with her lover remembers and grieves for her father and the life that she left behind. But the Qian who stayed home and was sick doesn't seem to have much memory of what happened. She's consumed with sort of the holder of the pain, the trauma, the illness. And traumatic memories can come back, like PTSD flashbacks. And just as often, they're kind of acted out as repeating patterns of behavior. You know, those kind of repeated relationships that you always get into. And then there's maybe a fourth, you know, if we've said so far kind of three types of memory: the sense memory, the narrative memory, the storyline, you know, and then traumatic memories that tend to either be kind of repeated, acted out, or kind of divided. And then maybe a fourth type of memory is actually no memory, is timelessness. And we just spent some time with timelessness in the retreat that some of us were at this weekend. And we kept company with a poem by Musō Sōseki. And the first line of the poem is, "Since before anyone can remember." So it's an evocation of a timeless time. And we could feel our way into that timeless time as present. And that timelessness exists alongside time, alongside this moment right now, and alongside the memories that we have. And it's not an either or, it's sort of the river under the city, you know. River under the river. It's always there. That timelessness, it underlies time, it underlies memory. And it can help to know that, to remember that, and to hold it alongside and within our sense of memory. So one thing that can happen in a life of practice is that it can help us look at and maybe shift our relationship to memories. And we can just notice the ways that we, without even being aware of it, we can be very fixated on a kind of, on sort of self-centered narrative memories. The story about who I am and why I am this way, what kind of person I am, what kind of person, you know, say my parents were. And again, it's not that there's anything wrong with that, but they get rigid and limiting. And practice and koans can really help us decenter from that and connect with sense memories, a feeling of memory that isn't so self-centered, that isn't so rigidly held. We can also start to notice areas of perhaps mandatory forgetting, you know, things that we have felt unable or just not accessible to memory. And it's an experience that I have in meditation of memories coming back, things that I haven't remembered in years. And sometimes it's not even in my mind. It's not like an account of something that happened. It's something in my body. You know, it's like a pattern of energy that feels like something that's sort of tight just opens up. And I can feel that it's an energetic sort of somatic kind of memory clench that gets released. And so I think over time we move perhaps in practice from having so much of the kind of rigid narrative memories towards just a more loosely held sense of memory and unsaturated memory with perhaps less charge. And in my own inquiry here, I will leave you with something that I've been sitting with, the way I've sort of held this question for myself, is there is no time. What is memory? So thank you for your attention, and I'm happy for any conversation.
I see Ellen's hand.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, Ellen.
You know, Megan, this is so interesting.